In this hour of the program, we will be talking with Dr. Donald Norman. He's professor of computer science and psychology at Northwestern University. And he is very interested in the design of objects that we use all the time in our everyday life, and how it is that the way those things are designed can either make them easy to use or difficult to use. And he's written a book on this, which is published a number of years ago, titled The Design of Everyday Things. And perhaps that's a subject that we'll touch on in this morning's program. But we'll also be talking about the subject of his most recent book, which is titled Emotional Design. And the subtitle there is Why We Love or Hate Everyday Things, in which he makes the argument that indeed we do have emotional connections, emotional involvement with the things that we use in our everyday life, and that we definitely have feelings about these things, and that the way we feel about them, whether they please us on an emotional level, not only affects the way that we feel about them, but it actually affects the way we use them. And he makes the argument that not only can something that is pleasingly designed please us, but it can actually work better. He explores all of these various things in his book, Emotional Design. It's published by Basic Books. It is now in the bookstores if you would like to take a look at it. In addition to teaching at Northwestern University, he is the co-founder of the Nielsen Norman Group. It's a consulting firm that promotes human-centered products and services. He has a website that has information about that, about some of his books, some of his essays. If you're interested, you might want to take a look at it. It's at www.jnd.org. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. Dr. Norman, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us today.
It's my pleasure.
How, I wonder, did you get interested in the subject of design, not only usability, but also simply how it is that people feel about things, and why some things we just like, even though we might not necessarily be able to say why?
Well, it's a somewhat of a long story. Let me see if I can shorten it. I started off as an electrical engineer. I have, in fact, 2 degrees in engineering and did some work in early circuits. And then by accident fell into the psychology department where I got my doctorate. So I have a combination of psychology and engineering, which turned out to be perfect to be working in high technology products. But I didn't for a long time until the Three Mile Island nuclear power accident happened. I was called in to look at it, you know, retrain those operators who did such stupid things. And I discovered that, gee, if you had tried to design something that caused errors, you could not have done a better job. That it was the design that caused the problems. And that sort of reopened my interest in engineering and design, which led me to, as you said, the design of everyday things. How come I can't open doors? I push them when they should be pulled, or I can't work water faucets or light switches. Going on to the design of computers and safety equipment. But all through this, I was sort of concerned that on the one hand, I preached we should have products that are easy to use, and on the other hand, I often bought products for myself in my home that were hard to use on purpose because they were so attractive I just had to have them. And I didn't know what to do with this contradiction until recently. I took a hiatus and worked in industry for about 10 years, and I've just come back to academics and discovered that in this period we've learned a tremendous amount about human emotion. And so with some colleagues at Northwestern, we've been able to put this together and realize how it impacts design. That, you know, if you feel good, things work better. And if you feel bad and you have some problems, ooh, that makes the problem worse. You get tense, more nervous, and it escalates. So I now understand how to put these together, and that's what this new book is about, why there are 3 levels of design. They must all fit together very nicely.
Well, before we go on to that, I am curious because you said that given your interest in good design, which means things that are, by their design, easy to use, things that virtually all you have to do is look at them and they will, in effect, they will tell you how to use them.
Mm-hmm.
You, though, looked around your own home and in your daily life and considered that they were things that you had bought because they pleased you, and yet they they were not designed that way. Give me an example of something that you found very pleasing, and yet something that, on the face of it, was not good design, at least from the standpoint of being straightforward and easy to use.
Well, actually, I have a collection of teapots that I just love to look at. One of them is a Michael Graves teapot. Not the famous one. It's one that's called Nana, and it's sort of bulbous and glass and transparent, and actually pretty awkward to use, but it's just so beautiful that I actually don't use it very much, but I put it in my kitchen window, and I look at it every morning as I make breakfast, and it just gives me some pleasure, just the sheer sight of it.
And for people, I know this is sort of hard to talk about because people can't see what we're talking about, but you have these, that's the way you introduce the book, and in fact there's a photograph of these pots, that one, then another one that the design of which I think is very intriguing, the tilting teapot, mm-hmm. that you orient it in different directions during the brewing process so that at one point it's tilted in a way so that the leaves are in the water when you want it to brew, and then when you tilt it another way, they're out of the water so that they won't continue to, you know, the tea won't continue to steep and get increasingly dark and bitter. And then there's the one that is the impossible teapot. This one that was designed by an artist on purpose to be impossible, so that not something to be used, but something to be sort of admired and puzzled at over, just as an image and as a thing. And the reason it's impossible to use is the handle and the spout are both on the same side.
Right.
So you just look at it and you think, what exactly was this person thinking? Did they think I was going to use this? And the answer is, well, no. That's kind of the point. But each, you know, what is it that each of those says and does, in fact, does each one of those speak to one of these different kinds of emotional levels? And I guess we haven't actually named them. They are the visceral, the behavioral, and the reflective, and they translate into three different kinds of design. So does each one of these pots, it serve as an example of one of that kind
Absolutely.
Of design?
Absolutely. The visceral level is really dealing with the appearance, and that's where cute little trinkets come to mind, or where just something that's attractive on the surface, a nice sensuous shape, maybe stainless steel and shining, and maybe feels good to touch. That's the visceral appearance level, and that's biological. It's automatic, and it's much the same for people all across the world. You want to know what that level is, look at what attracts children. Bright primary colors, bouncy songs and tunes, dissonant sounds are negative, bitter tastes are negative, sweet tastes are positive. That's all at the visceral level. Then there's the behavioral level, which is how it works. Does it work well? Does it feel good in the hand? Do you feel you have control? Do you feel you understand? And that's what gives rise to pleasure, or gives rise to the kind of rage that we have when we use our computers and they fail us, that we expect them to do this and they do that. Hmm. We call that expectation-induced emotions. And then finally, there's this reflective mode where the reason the impossible teapot is so wonderful is because well, look, you got to explain it, right?
Yeah.
That's kind of the reflective side. It's kind of nice. It's the intellectual side of emotions, but jewelry is about that. Jewelry is a reflective thing. I mean, why do we buy a really expensive watch when a cheap watch would tell just as good time, might even tell better time? We do it as a mark of status. We often change watches as we change our clothes to match the clothes. That's reflective level of design.
Hmm.
It has to do with self-image, with brand, the statement we're making. And they're all important. All three are equally important.
Yeah. And so I guess then with if you want to talk about the perfect design, would that be something that would incorporate all three of those?
I like to use the Apple iPod as my example. It's very attractive. It's an MP3 player, very small, sleek, attractive. It works remarkably well. The behavioral design is excellent. Given that it's a very small device and has to hold thousands of songs, it does a remarkably good job. And then finally, the reflective level, well, Apple makes a big point of saying anybody who owns an Apple product is special, right?
Hmm.
So those are the three levels, and this particular one device does all three very well.
Hmm. And of course, then of course there can be objects that would just satisfy one of those. There can be objects that perhaps would have a combination of a couple of those. But then I guess the ideal thing, the perfect design, is this thing that somehow manages to work on all of those levels.
Yeah, but we do have to note that I believe the visceral level is the same for everyone. The behavioral level is a function of your training and experience, and the reflective level varies dramatically from person to person and culture to culture. Take the Hummer vehicle. That's a reflective vehicle. It's making a statement. Very few people use its behavior. Mostly you buy it to state, look how important I am, look how big and powerful this is. I've heard owners say, no other car attracts as much attention. That's reflective. And for those very things that make it attractive to some people, it makes it hated by others.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not a universal response. It varies from individuals and culture.
When you think about what it is that moves us to buy things, and again, now here the answer might be, well, it's going to be different with every person.
The standard answer is, it depends.
Okay, so that was my question. Then it really does when you maybe we assemble a random selection of people and try to find something, some recent purchase, and we ask them, well, what is it about this thing appeal to you that everyone's going to say, it's not consistently visceral, or it's not consistently behavioral? It's like, well, with everybody that it's going to be, every object, every person, that's going to be a different mix of those things?
Absolutely. I've just done a study at the Nielsen Norman Group. We assembled a range of objects. We got three cameras, three digital cameras, three potato peelers, vegetable peelers, three cork removers, three espresso makers, three cell phones, a bunch of, and we went around the country. We did this in Boston and St. Louis and San Diego, and we had people come and look at them and use them. We told them what the prices were, and they made judgments. The interesting thing was we had a wide array of things. We had about 27 objects when we were finished, and every single object had people who preferred it over the others. And that's good, actually. That's why when you go into the store, you don't find one tea kettle or one radio or one television set. You find a wide array because each of us has something different in mind, and that the variety accommodates our different tastes.
Our guest is Don Norman. He's professor of computer science and psychology at Northwestern University. And as we have explained, and he has explained, he's interested in how things are designed, both for their functionality and for how pleasing they are to us. And in fact, he makes the argument that there is a relationship between how pleasing they are to us and how well they work. He argues that things that are aesthetically pleasing, in fact, they may indeed work better for us, or maybe we work better when we use them. If you're interested in reading some of his ideas, you might go back to his book, The Design of Everyday Things, and then his most recent, which is titled Emotional Design. The subtitle there is Why We Love or Hate Everyday Things, and it's published by Basic Books. In addition to his teaching and research work, he's also co-founder of the Nielsen Norman Group. That's a consulting firm that promotes human-centered products and services. Questions are welcome. You'll want to join in the conversation, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455, and here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. I'm interested in having you talk a little bit more about this idea that things that we find emotionally pleasing also work better for us. How is it that our feelings about an object's aesthetic features might contribute to whether or not it functions well? Or maybe just as the issue is, it's not so much the object, it's us and how we use that thing.
Right. Of course, it's us, not the object. But it always intrigued me that when I washed and polished my car, it seemed to drive better. And that sort of illustrates the puzzle that how could it possibly drive better? It can't. But I still felt better about it. Well, you take a look at a restaurant. Really good restaurants spend as much time on the display of the food, how it's laid out on the plate, the artistic rendering, as they do on the quality of cooking. And I really do believe that when it's laid out artistically like this, it does taste better. And the reasons are that the way the emotional system works, it actually impacts the way the brain works, that when you are tense, anxious, afraid, you squirt hormones into the brain and it functions differently. It tends to focus. focus. And that means if you're working, trying to solve a problem, and you have a difficulty, it makes you more anxious, and so you focus even more. And then you have more difficulty, you get even more anxious. And it's a positive feedback cycle that makes you feel worse and worse, more angry, rage. Whereas when you're in a good mood, it's very different. Again, we squirt different kinds of hormones into the brain, and we're actually much more creative. We look at new possibilities. We are more susceptible to interruptions, or the positive way of putting it is, we attend to all the stuff that's happening around us. And that means that if you're doing something and you have a problem, you have to say, oh, well, no big deal. I'll find a way around it. And so in the end, you don't even remember you had problems.
A moment ago, you talked about, I asked this question about what factors appeal to people about things, and you said, well, it's different with different people, and talked about how you went out and you bought a bunch of different corkscrews and different espresso makers and mm-hmm. different varieties of the same thing, that is to do the same thing. And then you brought people in and you asked them to use them and fool around with them and ask, well, okay, which one do you like best? And different people said they liked different ones, obviously. But I guess I wonder if you look at an individual person and his or her choices across a spectrum of things, do you find that generally people are, and then you look at these three levels of emotional response, do you find that certain people tend to be viscerals and others are behaviorals and others are reflectives? That is, in their choices, individuals are consistent about what they think is important, or does, and that also vary with what it, with the object that they're dealing with.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a wonderful question, and we've explored that, and we don't have an answer. That is, this was a preliminary study, and we didn't do enough tests. But the people like to describe themselves. We had one woman who basically said she was behavioral. She only cared about how well it worked. She didn't care about what it looked like. And another person who is really intrigued by the beauty, that would be a visceral level person. And another person who, people don't like to admit, by the way, they're reflective. No one likes to say, I buy it for the image it portrays. Mm. But there are clearly people like that. Yeah. And we detected people like that. But it's interesting because this wonderful functional woman who insisted she only cared how well it worked also admitted at the end that she would actually pay a bit more money if it looked good as well. It had to function well, but then she'd pay more money for if two functioned equally well, she would buy the more attractive one. And we had one alarm clock that was just wonderful, a Jacob Jensen alarm clock, a high-name designer. We found it at the Museum of Modern Art. It was beautiful, but nobody could use it. You couldn't even tell what time it was. And this woman thought it was just unbelievable. Who would ever want that as an alarm clock? And then she sat back and she said, you know, if this were bigger and I could hang it on the walls as a clock, then I wouldn't care if you couldn't tell the time, because who cares? It would be a good conversation piece.
Yeah, this is the clock, and I'm looking at a picture of it here. It's there are no hands, there are no numbers. What you get is a kind of a layout that has wedges, and somehow once somebody explains to you how it works, and then you'd look at it and say, oh, okay.
I get it. Tell me, you've looked at a picture. Is it AM or PM?
Oh, well.
First of all, it never occurred to you that it was a 24-hour clock, but it is.
No. Okay. I'm thinking, well, I guess I would say that it looks like it's about 7 o'clock and 45 seconds.
Yeah, but AM or PM.
Oh, but AM or PM. Because the wedges of the pie there are light, I'd say that it's AM. Am I wrong?
Who knows?
Oh, you don't know.
I don't know.
Oh, okay. Well,
I do this with salt and pepper shakers all the time. You get these metal salt and pepper shakers, and one of them has one big hole, and the other has a lot of small holes. And I say, how many people think the salt's in the one with the one big hole? And half the audience raises a hand. How many think the pepper's in that? And the other half raises their hand. Everybody has a good reason for what they believe, but each one believes something different. And then I tell them it doesn't even matter what they think. What matters is what the person who filled them thinks.
Hmm. Well, I guess then going back to, I suspect that if you did more on this study, more study of this issue of are people viscerals and behaviorals and reflectives primarily, that probably would turn out that it would, or at least the people think they are.
People
like to think they're consistent in their behavior, and it may not be, but they like to think that they are.
That's right. But that's what science is about, is that we have these hunches that we think are true, and quite often, of course, science gives us surprises when we actually do the studies.
Right.
So that, although I happen to agree with you, I might very well end up being surprised after we have done the proper study.
I'm interested in having you talk about another object simply because this is one that some people at least will recognize, and you write about it in the book. Anyone who has watched the NFL on television has seen this thing. This is the headset that the coaches wear. It was designed by Motorola, and you said that it's a really interesting case study of how these things, these emotional aspects of design, work. I was thinking about it just. I think that the original, the day that we were going to talk, I just happened to be sitting there and looking at the Chicago Tribune, and there on the front page was a photograph of the man who had just been hired to coach the Chicago Bears, and there he was. He was wearing that headset.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, if you watch the games and you watch the coaches prowling the sidelines, you see these things. And because of the way they're designed, they're pretty chunky, and the Motorola logo and name are big enough so that you just can't miss them. Maybe people haven't thought about that very much, but if you've watched a professional football game, you've seen this thing.
Right. It's an excellent design. They work well, and mind you, they have to really work well because it's a noisy environment, and it gets really hot, it gets really cold, it's raining, and the coaches, when they get angry, will rip it off with their hand and throw it on the ground, and they have to be able to put it back on and still use it. So it has to be very rugged. It also has a reflective side for advertising. Motorola is donating this to the leagues for advertising, so they wanted people to know it was Motorola. And it's done well. If you're right-handed or left-handed, if you wear it on the right or left, if you twist it around, there's always an M that's visible. But you know, it's not obnoxious. It's a small, subtle one, so that you can kind of subconsciously notice it's Motorola, but it doesn't interfere. So that's good. And finally, the coaches had to be happy. So it not only had to satisfy the coaches' functions that they needed, but it had to look like it's a football coach's headset.
Mm-hmm.
And the first couple ones that were made were actually small and lightweight, which the designers thought was preferable, and coaches rejected it. Ugh, that doesn't look like something I'd wear. You know, I'm coaching the biggest, beefiest, strongest teams in the world. I wouldn't wear that tiny little thing. So they had to come back and make one that looked appropriate to the coaches.
Well, it's interesting because I think it both has a sleekness to it, and yet it's very substantial. It's a very big sort of on the one hand chunky thing, and yet perhaps again that's a tribute to the design. It doesn't exactly look really massive and heavy, even though it is a big substantial thing.
Right.
I'm not sure exactly sure how that was achieved. I'm sure you know how that was achieved, or
right.
thought about but how that was achieved.
Again, it's a good example of something that's very appropriate for the situation. But take a rock singer, a singer who uses a headset. Also, they wouldn't want to wear this. That would just be very, very inappropriate. So once again, the design isn't that it's just good and bad design. It's good or bad for the person and the situation.
Mm. Well, the rock star, I'm sure, doesn't want to have anything detracting from them. They don't want you look. They don't want the audience looking at their headset. They want the audience looking at them.
Which is always wondered why these people who use wireless microphones and hold it, you know, within a half an inch of their face, and they're big microphones. You can't see their faces. That's always bothered me.
Our guest, again, in this part of Focus, we're about at our midpoint here, is Don Norman. He's professor of computer science psychology at Northwestern University. And if you're interested in reading about this, you can look for his recent book, which is titled Emotional Design, Why We Love or Hate, parenthetically, Everyday Things. And it's published by Basic Books. And also, you might want to look at his earlier book, The Design of Everyday Things, which I think is also very interesting, that looks at how it is that the way things are designed either make them easy to use or difficult to use, and that is a continuing interest of his. 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. I guess I'm interested in having you talk, and unfortunately here we're just going to have to try to describe things, but talk a little bit more about things that you think are nice examples of how all three of these things, these three levels, can all be satisfied in an object. Is there anything that sort of stands out in your mind as being another good example of how all these things can really come together?
Yes, I think in watches, the Swatch watch company has done a fine job of aesthetically pleasing, things that work well. They work incredibly well. People don't realize how difficult it is to make an accurate watch. And Swatch advertises itself as the company, emotional company. They're not selling timepieces, they're selling emotion. And they expect you to have multiple watches that you wear. You change the watch when you change the clothes or the activity. And automobiles is a second set. Not all automobile companies, but automobile companies were sort of the first to recognize the great importance both of engineering excellence and their styling. And of course, the different brands of automobiles represent different levels of reflective design, if you will. General Motors pioneered this, going from what they thought was a small and expensive brand, the Chevrolet, all the way up to the high-end expensive Cadillac. Over the years, that difference went away, and General Motors sort of lost their place. They're coming back. But I think that actually was a really good example of sensitivity to the reflective nature of design. We want to start out people with inexpensive cars and end up, as they get more money, with a bigger, more luxurious car. But it was thought of as a prestige item. Again, a reflective level of design.
When companies go about trying to design things, do they actually think about all of these things, or is the tendency to not focus on all, and perhaps just to focus on one of them?
I think that varies a lot with the company and the culture. Again, in the automobile industry, there's no question they think a lot about this. I read a recent interview with the designer of the 2004 Corvette, where the Corvette, all over its whole history, has had automobile headlights that hid, you know, and then the cover came and retracted. Mm-hmm. And for the first time, they had one that didn't have this automatic retracting cover. They had the new high-intensity light. There was smaller molded glass panel. They thought it was much more attractive and worked better, but the designer was very, very concerned that he had destroyed the Corvette image. And that's a clear concern about this reflective level.
Yeah.
And then there are others who have not. I mean, some designers don't, and I call that sort of emotion by accident as opposed to emotion on purpose, emotion by design. So it really varies a lot.
Maybe we could go back and talk a little bit about the design of everyday things. That I recall having talked, I think we talked about that, it's probably been quite a few years ago that we did. And it's something that I think is interesting, this idea that things can be designed in a way that either can make them easy to use or not. And in fact, I think you would make the argument, I don't know that everybody would agree, but you would make the argument that good design means things are easy to use. And in fact, that you can, sort of like your example of the door, when you come up to the door, you should be able to look at it and understand which way it opens, which side of the door the hinge is on, where you should press to get the door to open. You shouldn't have to come up to it and stand there and look at it and think, well, what do I do here?
Right, and it shouldn't need an instruction manual, namely a label that says push or pull. Right.
Well, what are there a particular set of ideas that go into designing things that are easy to use, that in fact tell you without having to tell you how
absolutely
to use them?
Absolutely. The technical term we use for this is affordance, that there are certain features that afford pushing or pulling or grabbing. The door, if you had a flat panel, say a metal flat panel on one side of the door, it would attract your attention. You would know where you had to push. And with a flat panel, what can you do except push? So you wouldn't need a sign saying push. There was nothing else to do except push. And there are many kinds of designs where you can make the structure sort of clearly illustrate the way it should be worked, the way it should be used. The houseware company OXO did a fantastic job of making household kitchen appliances and kitchen devices, tools, that are just obvious how to use in the first place, but second, that really function well, that are comfortable and easy to hold. And, you know, the story is that they were designed mainly for the original founder's wife, who was arthritic.
Mm-hmm.
But cleverly, they didn't advertise it as for people with arthritis. They said, this is better for everybody.
And people responded.
I've
used them, and a lot of people have. And, well, I think that sometimes, one, you come across a device, and you try to use it, and you think to yourself, did the person who designed this actually try to use it? Or did they, maybe if they could use it, did they then get three or four of their friends and say, here, try to use this. Tell me what you think. Somehow it seems that often users, the one set of input that never gets into design is average users.
Yes. Well, the problem there is that designers are the wrong people to evaluate their own work. That's true, by the way, of anything we do. If you're a writer, you're the wrong person to read what you've written and say whether it's any good or even to proofread it. You're too close to it. You won't even see misspellings. And that's a problem with many designs. Designers themselves look at it, and it looks perfectly good to them because they know what they had in mind. And so it's really essential in designing things that you test this out with the kind of person you expect to buy it. And you have to watch them use it without telling them the answers.
We have a caller here, someone to talk with. They're in Chicago, so we'll go there to line four. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if in your book you look at the Shakers' work at all, because I understand that they did not aim for beauty. They were purely focused on functionality, and of course most people consider their work exquisitely beautiful. So I've wondered if you analyzed any of their work. And my second question is, there seems to be a lot of books coming out on style, and I'm wondering if, is that where the research is going in corporations and businesses today, is the whole focus on how things look rather than functionality? I mean, you mentioned the Grave teapot that is beautiful to look at but doesn't function. Is that where research is going? Is that why we're focused on it, and why?
Okay, let me see if I can do both of those. The first is that the Shakers are basically really good examples of craft art, craftsmen, who build devices that are meant mainly to be solid and functional. And in general, crafts art and crafts are superb because they have sort of been iterated over for maybe centuries. That is, you design something and people use it, and then people come back and say, hey, build me another one, but, you know, it's this problem, and so it gets fixed. And over time, they turn out to work very well, and they tend to be sort of spare. They basically do what they're supposed to do with no excess frills, which makes them very attractive. I don't believe that they're designed to be attractive, but they end up being attractive because there's a pure case of form and function really do mesh. Mm-hmm. So I think that's where the attractiveness comes, that they're just pure, honest works.
Okay.
I'm not into style. My book is not about style. My book is about the way that a product must come together in all its dimensions to be pleasurable, useful, understandable by the person who buys it and is using it. And so all those books about style are books I usually don't approve of because they're emphasizing the appearance at the expense of everything else. There has been, though, lately, some much more emphasis on the emotional aspect. But as far as I know, I'm the first book that has really made this point in design, and what I've tried to do is give a framework for understanding these different dimensions. Virginia Postrill has come out recently with a book on beauty and the fact that it's okay for things to be beautiful. And so her book is similar to mine in some aspects.
are we looking for beauty in things because there isn't beauty around us? I mean, I look at a lot of the architecture, and being in an urban area, I feel that I'm surrounded by ugliness a lot. And I just wonder, are people trying to create their own beautiful environments?
No, I look for beauty because I'm surrounded by beauty. I live on a pond with ducks and geese and heron, and it's wonderful, and I'd like the inside of the house to be attractive as well. So it's not a substitute. Much of architecture, though, is unfortunately designed by architects trying to make a statement. Architects think of themselves as artists, and they're not building functional buildings that fit into the environment and that function well. They're making buildings that make some sort of design statement. They can win a prize. The pictures can be posted around the world. And that, I think, is inappropriate.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Other questions are certainly welcome. We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus. And our guest is Don Norman. He's professor of computer science and psychology at Northwestern University. He's also co-founder of the Nielsen Norman Group, and he is the Norman of the Nielsen Norman Group. It's a consulting firm that promotes human-centered products and services. His most recent book, the one that we've been mostly talking about here this morning, is titled Emotional Design, Why We Love or Hate Everyday Things. It's published by Basic Books. You also might find his earlier book, The Design of Everyday Things, interesting as well. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I don't know that this is maybe a difficult question, and I think it goes back, though, to one of the questions that the previous caller raised. We talked, you explained the fact that you thought that people respond to different features in products, perhaps in different degrees, that is on the immediate emotional response that you have, the issue of, well, how well does this thing do what it's supposed to do? How easy is it to use? And also some things that maybe come later. So this is the visceral, the behavioral, the reflective modes. And you said that in maybe some products that are really well designed satisfy all of those levels. I guess, though, I wonder, based on the question of the last caller, whether you think that there is this tendency now in the design of products to try to appeal primarily to either the visceral or the reflective, that does address the issue of style, or perhaps also addresses the issue of image, and it's that aspects of products that we buy them because they will make us more attractive, us more desirable, that people will look at that thing and us and think, well, you must be a special person because you have this thing.
Yes, that's correct. Of course, I don't approve of that. I think that's bad design. But sure, many products are attractive on the surface and basically have nothing else to recommend them. And many products, brand name products, for example, are meant to make a statement. I'm not sure I can tell one pair of jeans from another, but they have different brands on them, or expensive stores are, you know, expensive labels. Why do we wear designer labels on our clothes? We wear walking advertisements. Again, that's a reflective side of design. It offers no other benefit except proclaiming to the world, hey, look at me, I'm wearing Calvin Klein.
Well, we have a number of other callers here. In fact, the lines have filled up, so let's go to, we have someone on a cell phone. We'll go there first. That's line number four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I wanted to make a comment and see what you think about this. I've got a 14-year-old son, and it occurs to me that he evaluates prospective purchases almost entirely on the visceral and especially the reflective level. And so when we go out shopping together, we're sometimes at odds. And so I was thinking about this as you spoke, and thinking that the relative importance of one level of evaluation or another might also reflect on the superficiality of a culture. And it seems to me right now, design has to serve Madison Avenue marketing needs. In some cases, unfortunately, that's the primary issue. So thinking about a 14-year-old reaction to objects makes me think, well, we've got a kind of a teenage culture at the moment.
Well, I'm not... we have many cultures, but I think it's not inappropriate for a company to decide who they're trying to sell to and make it appropriate for that culture. Mind you, the fact that you and your 14-year-old are at a disagreement is kind of the way it is, because if you want your son to do something, the best way to do it is to say you hate it.
Well, fortunately, we're not that far along in disagreement about things. But I'm sure that during my lifetime, the way I weighted these different aspects of objects shifted during my lifetime, and I'm sure that's probably typical for any human being. But on the other hand, there's also constant pressure from general marketing emphasizing these issues, and I think that affects the individual as well.
But don't forget, teenagers have this real need to be different than everybody else, except to be the same as all of their friends.
Exactly. Well, I'm enjoying your conversation. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Well, do you think, Dr. Norman, that somehow these things, these three levels, somehow correlate with age? That is, as you get older, do you tend to become more behavioral and maybe a little bit less reflective?
That would be very logical, wouldn't it? I actually don't think so.
So the logical thing doesn't necessarily turn out to be the true thing.
Nope.
All right. Let's go to Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. This is a topic of great interest to me. I think that bad design of the kind that you're talking about causes a lot of frustration in people's lives, which we often blame on ourselves. We often say, oh, I'm stupid because I can't do this. When if you looked at how the item was designed, maybe that's really what's the problem.
Yep.
Sometimes we can laugh about it, like with the doors that don't have any indication of whether you're supposed to push it or pull it. But some things you might get scolded for. When I go to the grocery store and I see the little digital display on the credit card thing that says, press payment key to start. Okay, fine. Where's the key that says payment on it? There isn't one. You have to figure out that what they really mean is for you to press credit card, debit card, or whatever, one of those buttons. Bad design gets in the way almost every day, it seems like. And you're right about designers being the wrong people to test things. I've often thought that designers are young people who have strong, big hands. As I've gotten older, I've discovered that my hand strength isn't what it used to be, so it's really difficult for me to open jars or use tools or handle things that were really actually designed for a much bigger hand than mine and a much stronger hand than mine. And I also wonder sometimes if, as you were saying earlier, if things are actually tested at all. For instance, the easy open plastic wrap that's on a lot of food items, not easy to open. Have to take a pair of scissors to it usually. Another area that I find problems in is on the internet web pages, which are sometimes put up by young people with strong, strong eyes, and they might be able to handle that low contrast. You know, white on black, that's not low contrast, but it's hard on the eyes. But like a light gray on a colored background, that's really hard to read. Or the print's too small, or it's all in lowercase, and that might be a style thing and cool in some way, but it's very difficult to actually use. So I just wanted to hear your comment to all those random things I just threw out.
Well, you're absolutely correct. I mean, that's why my consulting company will never run out of business. It's amazing how we just have to continually educate each new generation of designers and companies, for that matter, that taking into attention their customers is absolutely essential.
Yep, I wish I could be a tester for a place like that.
Well, thanks very much for the call. We really appreciate that. So you do, in your company, you do have people who do designs, and in the design process, they come to you and they say, here's the object, how do you think we've done?
No, actually, what we do is we offer advice to companies. My partner works with websites, and I work with physical products. And we actually don't do the designs for them, but where necessary, we'll recommend designers.
Wow, okay. And do you help evaluate whether designs are successful
or not? Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And what we really need to do is And what I spend more of my time doing is trying to change a corporate culture so this becomes an integral part of the design process instead of something tacked on at the end.
All right, let's go to Urbana, line two. Hello.
Well, I have a perfect follow-up question to the person before me, unless you've answered this already because I tuned in late. With baby boomers getting older, and I'm beyond baby boomers, who came up with the idea of making pull-top cans for everything? If it's on soda, it doesn't matter to me. I don't drink that much soda. But I do have soup. I do have fruit. And to add insult to injury, if you have a hard time pulling up the... I can get the tab pulled up, but then I have a hard time pulling it back. I can't even use my wall can opener because the cans are designed now so that that doesn't work. Can you say something about that? Everybody's going to get older one of these days. Even the baby boomers aren't going to be able to open things.
Actually, a lot of these issues are not just age. That they actually affect everything.
Yeah.
And, but cans are actually really interesting because the invention of a tin can was important because it allowed food to be to stay on the shelves for a long time. But ever since the invention, people have struggled with ways to figure out how to open it. And there are all sorts of, if you look at the history of can openers, it's amazing what people invented. And there really hasn't ever been a completely satisfactory way. The pull-top cans were meant actually to make it easier and simpler, and in many ways they did. But as you point out, it requires some agility. If you have arthritic fingers, you couldn't use them. And you have to have some strength as well.
Well, that's it. Yeah, and then you can't help yourself because you can't, the wall can opener, the mechanical can opener, electric one, none of those work because you can't insert these cans into those systems.
But remember, part of what that was supposed to replace was the early days when you had to carry this church key, this special can opener to open.
Oh, I know. I've lived through a lot of them.
So in this case, I think a lot of good designers have struggled with trying to figure out ways of solving the problem, and they haven't succeeded. The problem here, of course, if you made it too easy, it might open by accident.
Oh, I see. Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go to line three in Champaign. Hello.
Hello. Don, I know one of the things you've concentrated on is what kind of design skills teachers need. And and that's a developing conversation. I find it odd that the curriculums down here are very much about the use of the tools like Photoshop and the rest and not about products. That worries me because it seems to be design is based on something that you can iterate.
There are actually fairly good courses in design, not enough, and they tend to be in the design schools and art schools and not so much in traditional academics. The University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign actually has a really good department that deals with a number of these issues. But one of their specialties is aviation safety, which is a very important area, but doesn't impact, say, the opening of a soda can. You're right. There are not sufficient courses in this discipline. It's considered too practical as a problem, and therefore not academic enough.
But we're training teachers on how to use a set of educational technology tools and thereby suggesting to them that they can both know how these tools are used for learners and help in the design of their local, you know, in-classroom use.
No, but there I think I agree with you that the tool is not what the issue is about. You have to have a design sense. You have to understand and have empathy with the people who are going to use your products, and that is what is not being taught.
Yeah, that's my observation as well. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you. Well, you know, I think that we're going to have to wrap up here. We have one more caller. I apologize. We cannot take, but we really just at the end of the time. For people who are interested in reading on the subject, A couple of books I'll recommend. The most recent by our guest, Don Norman. It's titled Emotional Design, Why We Love or Hate Everyday Things. It's published by Basic Books. You might also like to take a look at his earlier book, The Design of Everyday Things. And if you have web access, he does have a website. There's information there about him, about his books. There are some of his essays there. That's www.jnd.org. You can go there and take a look at it. And again, as I said, our guest, Don Norman, is professor of computer science and psychology at Northwestern University. And Professor Norman, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.